Welcome back to the program as we spend some time with a guest that has been with us previously, talking about his dramatic new novel entitled Cutting for Stone. It is my pleasure to be welcomed this morning by Abraham Verghese. He's a professor and senior associate chair for the theory and practice of medicine at Stanford University's School of Medicine. He was the founding director of the Center for Medical Humanities and Ethics at the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio, where he's now an adjunct professor. He is also, of course, the author of two best-selling memoirs, My Own Country and The Tennis Partner. It is my pleasure to have him here to talk about his new novel, Cutting for Stone. It's just out in paperback from Vintage. Abraham Verghese, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Delight to have you here. Why fiction this time? You've written numerous nonfiction works, essays. Why fiction?
You know, my first love was always fiction, and actually one of my first published pieces was a New Yorker short story, a very dark story about AIDS, and I thought that's how I would wind up describing the AIDS epidemic, through fiction. Instead of which I wound up, when people got to know a bit about my background, I wound up with a contract for a nonfiction book about AIDS, and that sort of started the ball rolling for nonfiction. But fiction's always been my first love, and also I've always had the sense that it's a very legitimate way of truth-telling. Dorothy Allison says, fiction is the great lie that tells the truth about how the world lives, and I think that's very true.
And one of the things that you tell about and talk about in Cutting for Stone is this sense of place, this sense of the importance of geography. Talk a little about that.
Well, I think, you know, for people who wind up living for the most part in one place, this is not as evident. But Napoleon famously said that geography is destiny, that you know, it seems very self-evident, and yet it's a profound thing, because if you move your geography for whatever reason, then your destiny changes. Or if a move is forced upon you, again, your destiny remarkably changes. And in this book, I wanted to play with that idea, with the idea of geography as a character and geography as an instrument of change in people. And so it was a great joy to write a book set in two continents and have one of the major characters go back from one to the other.
Of course, the corresponding part of that, of moving in terms of place, is the sense of the immigrant experience, of the sense of being a stranger in a strange land.
Yeah, I think the immigrant experience is, is really what makes America so wonderful, I think, especially to immigrants, obviously. And it's almost cliché to say this, but I think the immigrant, or the newcomer to any place, and, you know, I've had the privilege or the misfortune of being a newcomer to many places, from El Paso, Texas, to San Antonio, to Iowa City, to Boston, Johnson City, Tennessee. The newcomer brings a perspective and a way of looking at that situation or that town that allows certain truisms that otherwise would be inapparent to emerge. So I think it's both a narrative strategy, but it's also a fresh way of looking at things.
It's also the sense of seeing a place anew in ways that people that have lived there, either for a long time or all their lives, completely miss.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the best kind of praise I ever received for my first book set in Tennessee, or the second, The Tennis Partner, set in El Paso, was townsfolk telling me, you know, I've lived here all my life, and I had either stopped seeing or never saw some of the things that you described, because, you know, I just wasn't used to even looking for it. And I think it is a fresh perspective. I think it's part of what makes this country so energetic and great, is this constant renewal of ideas, and the fact that our demography is so varied and changing all the time. You know, the genome is being refreshed constantly.
What's the downside of that?
I think the downside is much of what we are seeing. I think immigration, both now and historically, you know, dating back to the Irish, the Jews, and so on, always brings with it, feelings of protectionism and feelings of, anger and resentment. And I think those are the things that one has to sort of work through. But, I often think that there isn't a country I can think of which has, basically welcomed and seen immigrants do so well and sort of formed such a part of the cultural milieu. I mean, I walk around Stanford, and you know, it's a veritable United Nations of people, and I can't help thinking that that will somehow make this a better place, richer in ideas than it ever was.
It makes it so much different than spending time, for example, at universities in other countries and seeing such a more homogeneous population.
Indeed, I think it probably explains some of the lack of imagination in places like that. So I had my medical education in India, but you know, it was a wonderful clinical education. I really appreciate what it did, but there was so little in the way of you know, of elective, or so little in the way of allowing oneself to develop in a certain way by choosing to do this or choosing to do that. It was all very regimented and set out, and I think that's an example of the kind of energy that some places might lack, and it might correlate with the immigrant experience.
You talk about the story in Cutting for Stone takes place on two continents, in India and in Africa. Talk a little bit about that story.
Well, you know, it's an epic medical story, and I really have, for the longest time, wanted to write an epic medical book, something of the kind of book that would bring someone to medicine, perhaps make them say, you know what, I don't care what happens with healthcare, I don't care what happens with reimbursement, but I can't possibly imagine a more fulfilling career than this one. And so I wanted this book to be entirely populated by medicine, if you will. I wanted it very much like Emile Zola's books about Paris, where every page, every character, you know, smells and reeks of Paris. I wanted every character to have a medical connection. And so it takes place over two continents and over two generations. It's very much about, you know, the great sort of passion of medicine, but it's also about its seamy underbelly. So I've been in medicine for 30-something years, and, you know, it's still to me every day a wonderful, glorious, romantic pursuit. But it does have an underbelly, and it can both save you as a physician, but it can also suck you in and destroy you. And so this book is all about that. And I always make the claim that what is medicine, after all, but life plus? You know, medicine is life at its most dramatic, at its most intense. And so I think that's why medical stories have universal appeal, because ultimately they're all about life. They're all about us.
Is that passion that's inherent in that, and even that underbelly you talk about, is that at the core of why medical stories, whether it be it fiction or whether it's movies, television, what have you, have such incredible staying power?
Yeah, I think so. I think that it's a combination of things. I think we all inherently have almost a prurient interest in our own bodies, and though we may profess disgust and shock, I mean, there's a curiosity that keeps drawing us in. And what is most interesting to me is that even though the television camera has taken away much of the mystery and the you know, there's no place the camera hasn't seemed to have entered, you know, the delivery room, the operating room, the trauma room, and nevertheless, there is a level of discovery and explication that comes through writing that's quite different. And you know, I think that explains, to me anyway, the reason that medical stories remain compelling, because there's a level of understanding you get that you can't get by just tracking a camera. And you might get the visual cues, but you might not get the level of understanding. But then I think you're right. I think the other aspect is that inherently there is drama in medicine. Aristotle said that, you know, stories are all about conflict, crisis, and resolution, or in Hollywood they talk about the three D's, drama equals desire plus danger. Well, you know, someone admitted to a hospital is in danger in a sense, and has a great desire to come out of their hole. And so inherently there may not be drama in many other aspects of people's everyday life, but any encounter with medicine has the potential to be tremendously dramatic. And I think that's why we're all drawn to such stories.
And one wonders, though, what impact that has, seeing so much of that world in drama, in fiction, what impact it has on people's day-to-day relationship with medicine and with doctors, because so many things that are the subject of dramas don't touch on things that people have in their own personal lives on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I hope that people can accurately separate, drama and entertainment from the reality. So I'm not much of a television watcher, and particularly have a hard time with medical dramas. My wife won't let me sit in the room because I start to grumble and criticize, and it's unreal to me. And what I'm not doing evidently is allowing it to be the entertainment that it should be. You know, but I think I worry that that a young person going into medicine sees Scrubs as being the reality, or ER, or House, you know, and God knows there are elements of all those things that ring true, but I think the most important part of being a physician, I would argue, is simply one's presence with the patient. I mean, in this day of hugely expensive diagnostic tests and machinery and technology and incredible resources that we now have, I've come to believe that more than ever the patient-physician interaction, that listening to the story, that examining the body, that ritual is terribly, terribly important. Rituals, we're told, are all about transformation. We marry with great ceremony because it brings about a transformation. We inaugurate presidents with pomp and a great ceremony because it brings about a transformation. I would argue that the ritual of one individual sharing their deepest, darkest secrets with another individual, something they wouldn't share with their spouse or their preacher, and then incredibly disrobing and allowing touch, which in any other context would be assault, I would argue that that has all the trappings of a very, very important ritual. And I think it's terribly important for us in medicine to do that ritual well. And frankly, as someone who believes in the exam, I think that if you do it well, you're about a day and a half ahead of people who have to rely on tests to come back to figure out what in the world is going on. So I think that I'm not sure that shows convey that kind of quality of medicine as well as, say, a book can. And I find myself revisiting some of the classic books that always, to me, rang of the truth of medicine, like, for example, The Citadel by Somerset Maugham, Arrowsmith, and so on. Classic books that brought a generation to medicine.
That ritual, though, has changed in so many ways, partly as a result of knowledge and information, that the ritual was for so long a kind of patriarchal experience, and information and knowledge has in some ways democratized that.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair statement, and that's how it should be. I think I would even say that it was not just patriarchal, it was paternalistic and very, very much veiled in secrecy. So, I think having much more information available to the patient is assuredly a good thing. But, I think it's interesting when you listen to the language that patients use when they complain about medicine. Very often they'll say, he or she never touched me. They put the stethoscope on my shirt. It wasn't even on my skin. Or they hardly had time for me. They didn't listen to me. So when I hear that, the commonality of those phrases suggests that to the patient, when one is ill, this is a critically important aspect of it. And the fact that there's fancy technology around to get at it doesn't substitute for the need, to have that meaningful interaction. And, I think the subtext in any doctor visit, especially for a serious illness, the subtext is, Daddy, Mommy, please help me. Mm-hmm. I'm scared. And we want someone who can, combine both the science and the art of medicine to leave you feeling that, you've had a therapeutic exchange and that you're on the right track.
In many ways, all that technology creates a greater need to both translate and to humanize that technology and knowledge.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you really hit the nail on the head. I think, it's actually made it even more acute. The problem that we've had some time ago has become even more acute because there's so many different people taking care of the patient. There's not one person. And, it's just this, the patient's sense is usually one of being in a very complex system and worrying that they're being overlooked or an error is about to take place because no one seems to be checking with them directly. And William Carlos Williams, one of my favorite poets and also a physician who practiced into his 90s, I believe, he used to say that when you're seeing someone, you are not seeing a liver or a heart or a kidney. You're seeing one guy or one gal who's in distress and who is handling it in their unique way. And he said the physician at the front line, what that physician needs is to fall back on his or her own sense of self in dealing with this person, in addition to their scientific knowledge and wisdom and so on. So I think that aspect of medicine, to me, is unchanged since antiquity, but I think in medicine there's been this illusion that, well, we don't need all that anymore because, you know, we can do this and we can do that, which is a mistake, I think.
Bringing together some of these ideas, how has the immigrant experience interfaced with medicine, that suddenly you're seeing doctors, people are seeing doctors that are not necessarily like them?
Yeah, and I think conversely, doctors are seeing patients who are radically not like them. You know, and so I think this has really forced on us a much broader need to understand different cultures, you know, the whole field of cultural awareness and cultural training. A great example is the Hmong experience that was described by a wonderful book, The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down, which in Hmong culture is the way you describe a seizure. The spirit catches you and you fall down. But in Western culture, we have a very rigid view of seizure, and you have to have an anticonvulsant, and by God, if the parents don't administer that, then they're guilty of neglect and will take the child to foster care. You know, so I think there's a possibility of great misunderstanding if we cling to our medical scientific beliefs without trying to adapt and appreciate the culture of the patients we're dealing with. And you're right, conversely, I think there's a lot of physicians of many different cultures, and I actually felt when I was caring for HIV in Tennessee that in many ways the patients were pleased to see me when they opened the door and met the physician for the first time, pleased that it was someone who was not, you know, from their hometown, not a good old boy who might have, you know, grown up in the town with them, and they probably felt that I would not judge them, or maybe I had no right to judge them. So all kinds of interesting, you know, ironies come about from that sort of stuff.
Talk a little bit about how some of that plays out in the context of this novel, Cutting for Stone.
Well, this novel, I think, deliberately, I wanted to contrast two kinds of medicine, the sort of resource-poor medicine in a place like in Africa, in a mission hospital, where you quickly realize that the number one disease you're fighting is not vitamin A deficiency or scabies or hookworm. It really is poverty, grinding poverty that then results in all these other things. And the book focuses very much on the problem of fistula, which is a obstetric injury from prolonged childbirth and delayed access to care. And, you know, when you think about fistula, a hole developing between the bladder and the vagina because of a traumatic delivery, that is really not a medical disease as much as it is a very good mark of the social development of a country. If you don't marry children off when they're too young, and if you didn't have child brides, and if they weren't malnourished, and if they didn't get pregnant so soon, and if they had roads that would allow a remote village to access public health, and if you had a public health clinic, none of this would happen. So I wanted to contrast that with the very resource-intense experience in America. But even within America, I wanted to contrast the sort of inner-city hospitals that famously and notoriously employ foreign medical graduates versus the sort of more exclusive university hospitals that, like the one I'm in right now, which traditionally don't. And I think many people don't understand that Medicare brilliantly came up with this idea as a means of manning inner city hospitals where no doctor would want to work otherwise. And that is, they provided money for training programs in these hospitals. So all of a sudden, an inner city hospital could now set up a residency and, you know, have residents, which immediately elevates the standard of care. The only trouble is that we don't graduate enough students every year to fill the residency slots that are available. And so every year there's this influx of foreign medical graduates, which people grumble about, but you know, without them, many an inner city hospital, you know, would simply not survive. So I wanted to tell all that story, and I do very much in this book.
And what is all that grumbling about? Why do people complain?
Well, the grumbling is interesting. The grumbling is not by the patients. It's you know, I think that physicians training here, rightly perhaps, have a sense of, you know, here I go through all this training, and, you know, we're bringing in all these foreign physicians who, you know, are practicing and making good money and good time. And there must be some resentment that creeps up from that. But I think it's, you know, I see it as directly the fault of the, you know, American Medical Association and bodies like that who have deliberately said for years and years and years, oh, we have too many medical students, and put caps on the number of medical schools. And, you know, so, you know, the truism about America is that whatever America needs, the world will provide. You know, if America needs 7'6" basketball centers, the world will provide. If it needs corn detasselers, they'll come from, you know, Mexico and South America. If it needs foreign physicians, they'll come from all over the world. So I think, you know, if America needs cocaine, Colombia provides. So these are not Colombian problems or Mexican problems. These are really our problems, and, you know, our unmet needs are quickly satisfied by the rest of the world.
And the doctors themselves that are practicing in these hospitals, how do they view the fact that they're looked on with such suspicion?
Well, I'm not sure you're... I mean, you're very aware immediately that you're in a two-tiered system. But I think most of us, my feeling was one of great privilege of, you know, having come to a land where, you know, all these advances that I could only read about otherwise were actually, you know, the order of the day. And for the most part, I mean, I was aware that, you know, I was training in a place that, you know, an American medical graduate would probably not train in. And I also was aware that, you know, I wasn't going to be able to get to a Harvard or a Stanford. That's just not how it worked. But I think the wonderful thing about America is that if you're good enough, and if you're good and you work hard, and perhaps the immigrant works even harder than anyone else, you rise to you know, to be able to get to the best places. And I guess my life is a good example. So here I am at Stanford, a place I could never have dreamed about when I was starting out. And ironically, I'm here at Stanford, I think, in large measure because of my writing, in the sense that I made a deliberate decision after the Iowa Writers' Workshop, which I attended, to go to El Paso, Texas, a small medical school, not greatly prestigious, one where all they wanted from me was to teach and see patients, and no demand for papers and NIH grants and that sort of thing. And I was able to write, and I think it's truly ironic that the two books I wrote there and my subsequent writing is really the reason that I was recruited to Stanford. And I often think if I had come here in the first place and had to work to bring in grants and write papers and get tenure, I probably would never have written a book, and might have not gotten tenure and be back at Texas Tech or somewhere like that right now.
Beware of what you wish for.
I know, and not to disparage Texas Tech. I owe that place so much. And my point is really that, you know, gems of medical schools exist all across this country. Some are very prestigious and nationally known. Some are not, but all of them do yeoman service to this nation.
How different does the mindset have to be when looking at doctors and the way medicine is practiced in other parts of the world as compared to here?
I think there are tremendous differences. I mean, you were talking earlier about, you know, technology and the lack of the, you know, how is that model any more applicable, the old-fashioned model? I mean, one of the problems we have here is that, you know, I'm all for healthcare reform, delighted that it happened, but it's not complete in the sense that we need some payment reform, too. We have a system where you're paid to do two people as opposed to do four people, in a sense. So this is a fee-for-service system, so obviously the only way you're going to make more fees is to do more service. And since procedures pay the best, we have this phenomenon of very few people going to primary care, more and more people going into procedures, and you have to believe that, you know, if your only tool is a hammer, everything looks like a nail to you. And you know, there are so many more procedures being done than any of us think is truly justified. And if we change to a model where, you know, we are paid for you know, disease management, for example, you would just see many of these procedures vanish. They just simply wouldn't be done at the level they're being done. So the great differences, I think, between us and many other nations in the way medicine is practiced has a lot to do with the way healthcare is structured and reimbursed. It has been almost a free-for-all here. You know, you could have prostate cancer, and your treatment would depend very much on who you went to see first. If you saw a urologist, you might go a certain way. If you went and saw a radiation specialist, you'd go another way. If you saw a primary care physician who was quite knowledgeable, they might even elect for best, for the good reasons, to tell you to wait and do nothing. You know, that kind of, you know, lack of uniformity, a series of cottage industries, is very much related to the way healthcare reimbursement is set up. It really has little to do with medicine, per se.
Mm-hmm. And has everything to do with business models.
Exactly. I mean, and, you know, I think one of the things that people didn't appreciate in all the vitriolic debate that, you know, went on is that, you know, we spend almost $3 trillion on healthcare, but every dollar spent on healthcare, this is so important, every dollar spent on healthcare is a dollar of income for someone, be it a physician, a hospital, a nurse, a pharmacy, a drug supplier, instrument manufacturer. And so the only way to bring down healthcare costs is to, you know, put a dent on that figure, which in turn puts a dent on people's incomes. And, you know, so you have to expect the kind of backlash. But, you know, it grew out of hand. It was so ridiculous. And, you know, the other day someone, my agent actually, in some context said to me, face it, Abraham, after all, medicine is corrupt. And I wanted to protest. I wanted to sputter my my objections. But you know, I look around and, you know, we have so many conflicts, you know, physicians owning MRI machines and, you know, CAT scans and having a vested interest in the hospital. And how can you really say in good faith that you're not sending a patient for a test, knowing that you need so many more tests to break even on that machine? You know, we're surrounded, even at the university level, by conflicts, you know, of subtle natures that I think make it difficult to say this is the ideal of medicine.
You know, we were talking about doctors that come here after training in other countries. You talked about your own clinical training in India. Is there anything in that training internationally that in any way prepares young doctors for some of these issues that we're talking about that they have to come to face here?
Well, I think, you know, everyone who comes here has to pass very, very rigorous exams. And so, you know, the clinical training, I think, is clearly has reached a standard for them to get here. What is unique, I think, in countries like Canada, Britain, and, you know, India and other Commonwealth countries is a great emphasis on the bedside exam. Because I think one important means to practice cost-effective medicine is to take a good history and examine the patient. And very often the diagnosis is apparent there. Whereas I think here, conversely, too often the patient arrives from the emergency room and has had all these tests that you know, were done almost before the patient got seen in some instances. And I think that that's certainly not cost-effective medicine. So, you know, I think that the ritual of the bedside is something we have never emphasized enough in this country, partly because the kind of clinical exams, the high-stakes clinical exams where a student or resident, you know, is tested at the bedside with a real patient, that kind of vanished in this country because it was felt to be too subjective. And so, you know, rather than refining the test, it was done away with altogether. So the analogy would be like we allow pilots to fly without anyone having flown with them. We allow people to be board-certified internists like me without anyone really being sure they can feel a spleen if it's there or that they can hear, you know, paradoxical splitting of the second heart sound, you know, things like that. And, you know, I think that is a shocker to most people when they truly realize that. The analogy would be a drunk looking for his keys under a lamppost, but he lost it out in the dark, but there's no light there, so he comes searching under the lamppost. We have multiple choice exams that, you know, admittedly are very standardized and very good and reproducible, but they do not test that aspect of clinical training that I think is so crucial.
Abraham Verghese. His new novel is Cutting for Stone. It is just out in paperback from Vintage. Abraham, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.